This episode of the American Birding Podcast is brought to you by HX Expeditions, offering mindful adventures to curious travelers since 1896. An HX Expedition cruise is the best way to see some of the world's rarest birds, like McKay's bunting. With onboard science centers, ornithologists, photographers, and a range of outdoor activities, an HX Expedition is a birder's paradise. Change the way you see the world. Book now and find out why birders are raving about HX. The 26th annual Great Salt Lake Bird Festival is being held in Farmington, Utah from May 16th through the 19th. It is open for registration on March 25th. You can get more information at greatsaltlakebirdfest.com. Hello and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I'm Nate Swick. If you are not from the United States and not inclined to follow sports, allow me to apologize in advance for the following segment. For everyone else, it's tournament time, baby. March Madness. And couldn't we use a little madness in the birding doldrums of the year? March Madness is great because it is not only the exciting conclusion of the collegiate basketball season for both men and women, but it is also the greatest assembly of sports team mascots in the world and an opportunity to look at birds through the lens of college sports fandom. So if you're looking for a breakdown of the tournament as a basketball competition, you, friend, have come to the wrong place. If you're looking for someone to tell you if a goofy sports mascot is ornithologically accurate, then I am your man, because no other event on the planet lies in the center of the Venn diagram of sports fandom, birding, and graphic design like March Madness. So let's get to it. On the men's side, 10 out of the 68 participating schools have a bird mascot, and unsurprisingly, Raptors predominate. We have the Seahawks from Wagner University, who, by the time this podcast airs, may already be eliminated. We have Owls from Florida Atlantic. We have two Eagles from Morehead State and from Marquette, the latter, even the more specific Golden Eagles, though I think that refers to an eagle actually made of gold and not Aquila chrysaotos, sadly. And we have Kansas's bizarre Jayhawk, which is neither a jay nor a hawk and looks most like a shoebill stork wearing pilgrim shoes. We have poultry, the ducks from Oregon, and the gamecocks from South Carolina, the former a Disney ripoff and the latter a participant in Bloodsport. But the two that take the cake in terms of ornithological accuracy are the peacocks of St. Peter's University and the Blue Jays of Creighton, both of which show the birds in profile, with Creighton's having all the right markings. It is well done. Someone in their graphic design department cares about birds. We have 10 in the women's tournament as well, and there's also the benefit of a bird team actually being one of the favorites to win the whole thing. There is some overlap with the men's side. Marquette's Golden Eagles, Creighton's Blue Jays, South Carolina's Gamecocks, the aforementioned favorite, and Kansas's Shaden Storks are participating in both tournaments. But as for the different schools, we have two different eagles from Florida Gulf Coast and Eastern Washington, both places where you can find plenty of bald eagles. There's an owl here too from Rice, and I will give you a reminder, don't feed rice to birds. There are also these Skyhawks from the University of Tennessee Martin. The logo is a hawk wearing goggles and a bomber jacket. I've already made my opinions clear on birds wearing clothes, so that one is not going to get far on my ranking. We do have a couple more esoteric references to birds in the women's tournament, though. The Iowa Hawkeyes are a top seed, and Hawkeye is more a reference to the character from the book The Last of the Mohicans, and more recently, just a reference to a person from Iowa. But the logo is a cool, stylized hawk head, so maybe half a point there, although I'm wary that the official University of Iowa literature calls it a tiger hawk, which is more a branding exercise than a bird. Also, the Chattanooga Mocs have one of those ambiguous names, but their mascot is Scrappy the Mockingbird, who is, in some images, driving a train and wearing a train conductor's hat. If you're looking for a mascot that implies a sort of feisty tenacity, you could do worse than Northern Mockingbird. Though I did find out that the Mocs used to refer to the water moccasin, a venomous snake, that was changed in the 70s to an exaggerated Native American caricature, which was thankfully changed to the bird in the 90s. Why they didn't just go back to the snake, I don't know. But if you're a herpetologist, you know, maybe that's motivation to pick their opponents in the bracket. As to which is the most accurate, it's Creighton again. I don't know what to tell you. It's a great logo. And as long as they're in it, they'll win it. Congratulations to the Creighton Blue Jays. Two-time winners of the American Birding Podcast NCAA Bird Mascot Tournament. On the show this week, we are back in the archives. For many people, spring means the return of American robins, though birders certainly know better than to hold to that old myth. But that doesn't mean American robins aren't honest-to-goodness long-distance migrants. Researcher Emily Williams joins us to talk about the incredible things we're learning about the movements of a very familiar bird. All that after this week's Rare Birds. This is your Rare Bird Focus for the second week in March 2024. Finally, we have a bird to discuss, and it's an absolutely wild one. But first, I'll preface this by stating that eBird has been down for a few days, a planned outage, not unintentional, at the time of this recording, so I don't have all the information at my disposal that I normally would. I apologize. In any case, a white-tailed eagle, essentially the Eurasian counterpart to the familiar bald eagle of North America, was photographed this past week flying by San Francisco, California. It passed through the Golden Gate, heading north, where it was photographed by a local birder, suggesting that it had been spending the winter undetected in parts further south. This is a first state record for California and the first well-documented record away from Alaska, where it is a rare but semi-regular vagrant to the Bering Islands and the Aleutians. Of interest in the wake of this finding is the fact that there are a small handful of old records from the northeast of the AVA area, the most recent from 1944. There's also a site record from Oswego County, New York from 1993 that was not accepted by the Records Committee at the time, but remains one of those could have been kind of birds. It would be fairly easy for a white-tailed eagle, particularly a young bird, to go overlooked just about anywhere on the ends of the continent. There are structural differences between bald and white-tailed eagle. The latter has broader wings, sort of a deeper belly in the secondaries and a different shape to the primaries with seven fingers instead of six. But these are very subtle, and it would be easy for someone to just toss something off as a bald eagle, even a normal bald eagle. But it does suggest that there are reasons to look closely at young eagles that look maybe a little off in the non-breeding season. What we lack in quantity this week, we make up in quality. But for the full list, check out the ABA Rare Bird Alert on Fridays at aba.org/RBA. You can also follow along with all the rare bird news in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and in ABA community. What can we learn from one of the most familiar birds in North America? A bird so well known that its migration is remarked upon by friends and colleagues who might otherwise have no knowledge about birds more generally. I'm speaking, of course, of the ubiquitous American robin. But there's a lot left to learn, even about a bird that everyone seems to know. That is, in part, the work of my guest, Emily Williams. She is an avian ecologist at Georgetown University, currently studying the migration ecology of American robins. Hello, Emily. Welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Nate. Thanks for having me.
So, like, how did the robin become your study species?
So, it kind of goes back before I started at Georgetown. I previously was working at Denali National Park and Preserve in Alaska, and I started working with robins then. And it kind of started with a friend and collaborator of mine, Dr. Alex John, who's at Indiana University. Kind of his whole research program is doing these temperate tropical comparisons between either birds in the same genus or really closely related species.
Oh, cool.
And most of his background is in South America, mm-hmm. and he was doing a lot of work on tortoise thrushes in South America. And he wanted to have this North American equivalent. And so, of course, for most of North America, the only tortoise is the American robin. And so he had approached me because he wanted to do this really widespread look at robins across their range. And me being in Alaska, Alaska is a pretty cool place, not only for it being Alaska, but for birds in general.
Definitely.
And so he had approached me about joining on doing this robin stuff. And so initially, we just started putting some tags out on birds to learn about their migration, but then it really transformed into, once I left my job at Denali and then came to Georgetown, became the focus of my dissertation because, number one, we're in a pandemic, and what better species to work
right.
with
than the one that's in your front yard?
Then, yeah, it requires like no travel to right. get to. So it's a really great species from that standpoint. And then in terms of the stuff that I'm really interested in terms of research questions. The stuff that really gets me going is learning why birds migrate, what shapes why some birds migrate and some birds don't. And the robin is a pretty perfect species for that question. And surprisingly, as you started off this conversation, you know, you'd think that we'd know a lot about robin migration, right, but it turns out we know very little.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention all the tortoise thrushes. One of the things I love about robins and that whole genus is like everywhere you go, just about everywhere you go in the world, there's a tortoise thrush kind of doing robin things. Like you go to Central America, there's clay colored thrushes walking around in the gardens, picking up worms. You go to Africa, there's African thrushes doing robin things. I just find that so cool. European blackbirds in Europe, you know, it's neat to be able to compare that to species that are more or less, you know, filling similar ecological niches, no matter where in the world that they are.
Totally. I mean, the tortoise genus is amazing because it's literally on every continent except Antarctica.
Yeah.
So, you know, this robin stuff, even though it's the focus of my dissertation, there's a lot of opportunity to not only compare to South American tortoise thrushes, but we can make global comparisons of tortoise thrushes across the world. Because like you said, they do similar things. And I think this pattern of having some birds migrate, some don't, and doing really different things all across the range of robins is probably similar in a lot of tortoise thrushes where they occur elsewhere.
American robin, such a familiar bird on everybody's lawn, cities, suburbs, way out in the rural parts of the country too. Do you feel like you have to, you know, push back at all on the idea that there's very little left to know about this species? You know, people feel like they know it, but they don't really know it.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think one of my favorite things with my PhD is, you know, the work that I'm doing is very urban. So I'm working in a lot of private backyards. I'm working in public parks. And, you know, as it goes with working in these areas, you see a lot of people. And you know, a lot of people see me with binoculars or they see me with a mist net and they're immediately like, what the hell are you doing? A lot of people, I'll say I'm working on robins and then they just like, oh, okay. And then they just continue walking. Like,
yeah, right.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm just going to go about my day.
What do you want to know about these things? Yeah.
But for people who know a little bit about birds, at least, they'll say, oh, just the robin.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, what do you mean, just the robin? And so, for sure, it's like, and birders too, you know, robins aren't that, you know, it's not that exciting bird that you chase or you go to some far off place to go see because they're literally everywhere. Yeah. And so, for sure, I get a lot of pushback from just the general public as well as birders in terms of robins just aren't exciting. And then people just assume that because they're common, that means that we know everything there is to know about them. And so it's the tragedy of the commons, as I say, that a lot of common birds suffer this, that they're super common. So people just overestimate what we know. And because they're common, people aren't excited about them. So they just like get left out in terms of research because people are like, I'm going to go after that golden-cheeked warbler because that's way cooler. And so, you know, we have all these common species that we don't know a lot about.
Yeah, they totally get overlooked because, as you say, like people want the flashier conservation story. You know, robin is relatively stable population, but they're still doing things that can apply to these, I know, flashier, for lack of a better word. I know robins are pretty flashy. Like I've seen those kind of bright male spring robins with a black head.
Totally.
And they're a really good looking bird. If we're making conservation decisions about all sorts of birds, then we need to know the common. We need to keep the common birds common, for starters. Like, it should be like the bare minimum of the conservation efforts.
100%.
Yeah. So what have you learned about American robins that has surprised you?
Well, dang. I mean, I feel like most things that I'm learning about robins surprised me, honestly. I guess in terms of the stuff that's the focus of what I've been doing, just that what we're learning about their migration so far, I think is pretty amazing. I mean, another thing that I get when I talk with people about robins that either are birders. So I get kind of like people in two different camps. Mm-hmm. The people who are birders, I'll tell them that I'm studying the migration of robins. And some people that are birders are like, I'm so excited that you're doing this because I've always wondered what the hell robins are doing.
Where do they go?
And then the other camp is like, oh, robins don't really migrate, or they're around all the time. You know, why are you doing that? And then I also get that from the general public that, you know, people who are not necessarily birders, not scientists, but appreciate birds will say, well, the robin in my backyard, I see it year round. And then I'm like, are you sure about that?
Right. Yeah, is it the same robin?
So that's when I go into my spiel about how that robin that's in your backyard in the middle of Indianapolis could be that same robin that you're seeing all year round. Or it could be a robin that's just spending its summer there, but is going to go further south to spend its winter. Or it's a robin that's moving through on migration, or it could be a robin that wintered there, but it's going further north to mm-hmm. go spend its summer. And that kind of encapsulates the variation that we've been seeing with the GPS tag doing with robins. So we've gotten preliminary data from Alaska and Indiana at this point. I've been tagging robins in the Washington, D.C. area, so we don't really have that data yet because the robins haven't really started to move. Mm-hmm. But from Alaska and Indiana, the birds that we tagged in Alaska were tagged in Denali. So all those birds were what we call complete migrants. So all of them migrated. And where they spent the winter was really different. So, or not two robins did the same thing. Huh. So we had one robin that went to Texas, another that went to Oklahoma, another to Montana, another to Nebraska. So they went to completely different wintering areas. And then in Indiana, we had what are called partial migrants. So part of the population migrated. So we had some robins that migrated and some that didn't. And same thing with the ones that migrated. They went to completely different areas. So we had robins that went to Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, Texas, Louisiana. So they went to completely different areas. And then we had some robins that they stayed in Indiana for most of the year. And then for a month, they went to Tennessee and were like, hey, I'm going to check out Tennessee. And then I didn't like it. I'm going to go back to Indiana. So there's just been a lot of variation in what they're doing, which is making me really question the labels that we put on not only robins, but birds in general. You know, what makes a migrant?
Alaska to Texas. I mean, that's an impressive movement. Like, that's on par with a lot of birds that we look at with amazement, you know, how far they're going. That's pretty mind-blowing know that they're making that sort of crossing.
I am being advised by Dr. Pete Mara at mm-hmm. Georgetown. And of course, most people who know Pete and his research program, he's done most of his lifelong work on American Red Starts. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of personal enjoyment by telling him how the American robins in Alaska are actually migrating farther than
totally
his American Red Starts.
One of my very first really memorable birding experiences when I was a teenager just getting into birding was on a Christmas bird count, and we saw like just massive American robin roost that was flying out of this, you know, copse of trees in the morning. And I forget how many we counted. It was in the hundreds of thousands, but it was just like streaming birds passing overhead. It's amazing to think that those birds could be coming from, and this was in Southwest Missouri. It's amazing to think that those birds could be coming from all over North America potentially, and all ending up here in this little patch of trees. It's just outside of, you know, a city. It's pretty crazy to think about.
That's amazing. I've heard about some of those roosts in Missouri, and I really want to see one.
Yeah, it's a lot of birds. And it's just like and it's not like a big concentrated flock. It's just, you know, for half an hour, you've got just robins in the air moving. It seems like the American robin, more than most, is a species that's sort of well-suited for a rapidly changing world, for for better or for worse. What is it about them that sort of allows them to survive and even thrive?
I mean, that's a great question. You know, we don't really know the answer to why is it that robins, in comparison to a lot of other species, seem to do so well. You know, they are pretty much everywhere across the North American continent. I mean, it's one of the selling pieces I give to them is that, you know, when you look up on Cornell's All About Birds website or any sort of resource that says something about bird species, you look up the robin and it'll say nesting substrate, it'll say ground, tree, shrub, whatever.
All of it.
And so they will nest on basically anything. They can occur in pretty much every habitat except underwater. And they have this enormous geographic range. And so it just begs the question, how do they do it? What makes them so adaptable and why? And we really don't know, but I think that because they are so adaptable, and hopefully, you know, some of this migration research will learn, you know, is it just that are they more attuned to their surrounding conditions in terms of making these decisions rather than, you know, the idea of them being more programmed to do these things? And my guess is they're not, you know, and it'd be really cool to take those Alaska robins, drop them off someplace else and see what they do, compare, you know, those Alaska robins to robins, in the more southern parts of their range. But, in terms of like rapid environmental change, they would be a great species to look to see how are they dealing with climate change. And we already know from a more recent study that they are adjusting their migration times in anticipation of earlier springs. So we can use them as a sentinel species to say, okay, well, this isn't a very adaptable species. So can we compare across other species like dark-eyed juncos, for example, which are also super adaptable? Another species, how are they going to cope with things like climate change or increasing human development? Or whatever.
Yeah, it seems like there's not a habitat that they can't manage in. And as you say, you know, they're not obligate migrants. Like they can decide not to migrate if they don't necessarily have to. And it seems like in cities with a lot of ornamental fruiting trees just really seems to attract them, especially in the winter these days. I mean, I see more kind of urban robins around than maybe I've been overlooking them. That's almost certainly true for so long too. It seems to be the case with the species, but they manage really quickly. Like they're really plastic. It's really interesting.
Yeah, totally.
Doing your work in sort of urban suburban landscapes with a lot of people. Do you find that when you're telling people about your work that they seem sort of interested in these larger conservation concepts like migration, connectivity and things like that? Because, you know, the American robin is the face of this. You know, they're familiar, they're connected to it. Do you think we can use the robin and sort of the cool things we're learning as a way to encourage people to be more interested in these concepts more broadly with other bird species?
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people who aren't associated with birds in any way know what a robin is. You know, they're like, oh yeah, I know what a robin is. I see it in my backyard. And so that's my hope, is that you can use this, kind of use the face of the robin to launch all of these conservation ideas to people and use what we're learning to say, hey, like planting native in your garden does amazing things for not just robins, but for all these other species. In terms of interacting with people, in getting the sense of, do people have this mindset? I would say that's kind of hit or miss. You know, it seems like you know, the people who I say robins, they just continue walking along.
Hard to reach them.
Yeah, hard to reach them. I would say, you know, those people, I don't know. I don't know what their values are about conservation. But I've had a lot of people who stop and have talked with me for half an hour and will say, thank you for doing this very important work. Mm-hmm. You know, you're doing really great things. And so I think there is a high potential for a lot of those people. And also just because it is such a public facing project.
Yeah.
I really do hope that there will be all of these benefits in terms of just not only just increasing awareness about birds and appreciation for birds, you know, the people that are behind doing the research and learning about them, but also what people can do, easy steps they can do to make things better for birds.
Yeah. I was, you know, checking into some of your work on that you've talked about on various websites. And one of the things that I found sort of interesting was the connection between robins and Lyme disease. Now, obviously, we're talking a lot about public health these days. It's on the front of everyone's mind. You know, how are birds impacting people's public health? How do robins potentially cause problems by spreading out into the landscape and bringing ticks and potentially bringing this this harmful pathogen?
Yeah, so that's a lot of work that Alex John that I mentioned earlier in the conversation. He's working on that with Dr. Dan Becker, who's at University of Oklahoma, I think. I always get the University of Oklahoma, Oklahoma State confused. So they're studying more the disease dynamics of Lyme. So not just Lyme, but other tick-borne pathogens, malaria, etc. And so far, of the samples that we've been taking, I don't think that they have seen Lyme in the blood samples we've been taking in robins. Mm-hmm. But there is this high potential because, you know, they can be a vector for Lyme. They're in these places where humans are, like, you know, you see robins in really human-habitated areas. Mm-hmm. And so there's this possibility that a tick that came off of a robin, you know, somehow gets onto a human and it can transfer Lyme. So there's this big potential for it. And I'd say that, you know, my knowledge of the Lyme aspects of this project are not that great, but I would say that there is this high potential that it could be this big disease vector. And then the really important piece is linking it to their migration behavior. Because like you were saying with that roost in Missouri, the fact that these robins could be coming from all these different geographic areas could be like, in terms of disease, could be huge. So there's a lot of potential for not only working with robins and disease, but what we're learning about their migration.
How many times have you had to explain to people that the robins aren't really returning in spring and that they've been there the whole winter?
Many times. Most of the time, I'd say. Or not even that, you know, like explaining the opposite, that people be like, oh, that robin that I see is my robin. And I'm like, it's not really a robin.
It is interesting the extent to which robins have sort of, because they're so familiar and because people are inclined to notice them when they pop up on their lawns, how that myth has I don't even know when it started, but it's like hundreds of years old.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is if you do a Google search of American robin spring, there will be all of these articles that pop up of how robins are this harbinger of spring. And so people associate, I see a robin, oh, it's springtime. You know, the robins are finally back from wherever they were for the winter. Yeah. But then there's all these other articles that say that this is a, you know, this is a misnomer. This is a phrase that is made out of error because robins are in my backyard all year long. And they don't really tell me what spring's happening anymore. I think it's two things. You know, I think a lot of this is probably that robins had this type of variation in their migration always.
Yeah.
But I do think it's changing. You know, I think and this is something that hopefully my research will unveil, is my hunch is that I think that they're basically that line delineating where they're resident is moving northward.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I think basically a lot of robins that say went to a place to go winter are just staying. So basically their wintering range, the range boundaries of that is moving northward. Is my general sense.
Yeah.
You know, you talk to a lot of people about robins, they'll be like, oh, I think they're expanding their summer range. And I don't necessarily think that's the case because there's a lot of legacy data of robins. I always like to tell this little anecdote about robins being in far northern places, but there's this legacy data set that I came across when I was working in Alaska that I don't know anything about this project, but it was some like old school citizen science project where people were filling out nest cards of species. And so when I was looking up these nest cards for robins, you know, there are reports of nesting robins in, you know, what's now Utyabek, Barrow, Alaska, from the 60s. You know, so there are these old nest cards from 50, 60, 70 years ago that are in places in Alaska, because this was an Alaskan project, that they were nesting there. So it's like one thing to say like, oh, like this is just like a report that, that they saw this bird. So yeah, maybe it's a vagrant. But the fact that there's breeding information for robins in these really northern locations in Alaska, you know, makes me think that maybe their breeding range was always pretty far north. And the reason we think that they're expanding is we're seeing them more because more robins are staying. And of course, like all these far northern places in the country, not only in Alaska, but in Canada, you know, they're sparsely populated. So we're not going to know about robins being there because there's just not people there to report seeing them. It's like seeing them breed.
Like a black hole of data almost.
Right.
That's really interesting. And I would imagine like a robin nesting in Utyabek would be, I mean, there's not many trees for them to nest in up there. So they would be nesting on like someone's house like they do. Like they do down here, and probably
Totally.
It feels intuitively like it would be good data.
Yeah, this is one of the nest cards that I came across. It was I can't remember the exact location, but it was like, you know, maybe 50 miles south of where Utyabek is, and it says, you know, it's like kind of a classic nest card. It says, you know, species, clutch size, date that you found it, substrate the nest is on, and it has, you know, same thing, tree, shrub, whatever, and it has other, and then the handwritten is airplane. So there must be some abandoned airplane in like remote Alaska that a robin was nesting.
Closest
on.
Thing to a tree they could find.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. Emily Williams, an avian ecologist at Georgetown University, currently studying the migration ecology American robins. She's an active science communicator on the internet, and you can find that information in the show notes. I'll put it there. Thank you so much, Emily. This was really fun, and good luck catching those robins that you've tagged.
Thanks, I need it.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA. If you enjoyed this podcast, you'll be eligible for a lot of great benefits, including our fantastic magazines, all our online stuff like the magazine archive, the identification portal, discounts to partners like OM Systems, Studio Books, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and more. Special shout outs this week to Lori DeMott of Belmont, New York, Aubrey Fredland and family of Corpus Christi, Texas, Stephen Hadidi of Lantana, Texas, Maria Mazurek of Sunnyvale, California, and Alan McGrew of Beaver Creek, Ohio, all of whom recently joined the ABA, noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Thank you so much. Welcome to the ABA. Executive director of the ABA and executive producer of this podcast is Wayne Klockner, who notes that the most NCAA championships won by a school with a bird mascot is 4 by the Kansas Jayhawks, which should count as 8 for the purposes of our records because it's 2 birds each time. Technical production is by John Lowry, who points out that on the women's side, the Stanford Cardinal has 3 NCAA basketball titles, but rightly notes that those should be vacated by the NCAA because there are no Cardinals in Palo Alto anyway, and the mascot is a tree. Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese, who pointed out that I missed Virginia Tech's Hokie Bird in my count of mascots on account of it being a weird turkey and not an actual bird, though that does mean that it is described accurately as a Hokie Bird. You can find us online at aba.org, on social media most everywhere as American Birding Association, on Blue Sky. We are at ABA Birds. Questions, comments can come to podcast@aba.org. I'm Nate Swick. Thanks for listening. Bird like Tom, and we'll see you next week.